Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Caitlin Mathis.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Agnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Stone from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yep.
Yes, indeed. Welcome back to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. And it promises to be a really good one. We're catching up with the former Matildas assistant coach, Spencer Pryor, who is now the head coach of the Thailand women's team. And it'll be interesting to hear his views on how they're going and the challenges he faces coaching up in Thailand at the moment. But I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
Well, John, the Olympics have come to a close, and well, I must admit they didn't get me that excited. There were some wonderful moments, there's no doubt about it, but I just kind of struggled to get enthusiastic about it. I think some of that was the constant chopping and changing of the channels.
I must admit, I did find it difficult to even find when events were on. I'm not sure that that's a broadcaster's problem or other issues to do with it, but it was very difficult. My partner wanted to see the horsies, and she had a great deal of trouble trying to figure out when the horsies were actually on, which was a bit of a pity. I mean, there's been some complaints about the coverage, and a channel hopping was a big one for me.
It infuriated me.
Yeah, why am I changing?
Suddenly things were changing. Also, you were seeing stuff that you knew wasn't live when there were live events on, and that always frustrates me. Okay, yeah. You want to have a flashback or something, that's fine, but sort of pick an opportune moment. And I also, the one thing that I found really, and I think this had a massive impact, to be honest, was I thought the presenters were so flat, so boring, and there was just no enthusiasm, there was no vitality to the presentation. You know, this is an event that happens for 2 weeks every 4 years. You'd have thought there'd have been a bit of, whoa, this is exciting. But it was just so boring and monotonous and done sort of on auto cue, and it was just, yeah, dull.
Certainly by the second week, that's the way it felt. That was, oh, now another event. Let's be straight with it. That's a huge undertaking. To broadcast an Olympic Games for any broadcaster is a huge undertaking. And there's a lot of issues involved, and you're going to get, you know, clashes with programming, et cetera, et cetera. But they've got their three channels that they were using. I just saw...
And the app.
And the app.
Which I could not get to work, I have to say. I could get it to work, but when you had to sign in, I had huge problems every single time.
Well, I had some issues with free-to-air broadcaster telling me I had to give them money. And then not only that, there were ads played in it. Well, hang on a sec. But that's another argument. It's very easy to criticise in such a huge endeavour. There's always going to be things that go wrong. There's always going to be things that you could do better, et cetera, et cetera. What I get a bit annoyed about is when I hear people from other countries saying, oh, this is rubbish. Where I'm from, we get blah, 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 blah. We see X, Y, and Z. And when you guys get to see nothing. Where's this event? Where was the handball? I wanted to see some handball.
I didn't see a single second of handball, and I love my handball.
It's not a sport we get exposed. The only time you get exposed to it is during the Olympics, and that's when those sports deserve to be exposed. I don't need to see another puff piece about an Australian athlete who... is a good chance for a medal, whether or not they get it or not. That's for afterwards. Puff pieces are for after, not before.
Now, I think you make a very good point there, John, and this is what I find sad. I think there's a lack of maturity in the broadcast, and I'm saying that having worked overseas and whatever, and having also watched the Olympic Games in other countries in the past. And I just think, yes, we want to see how our local athletes are doing. That goes without saying, but we also want to know how the athletes from around the world. And all we tended to get was Usain Bolt, Mo Farah, the big names, you know, Michael Phelps. We didn't see a lot of the other athletes that were from other countries that still did well that may not have been the big names that we were all talking about.
And never was that more exemplified than in the women's 100-metre final with the two Campbell sisters out there. Now, before the race, they showed the girls... They were laughing, they were joking, they were carrying on, they were having a great time. Oh, look at how relaxed they are. Look at how relaxed they are. Yeah, look at how relaxed they were. So relaxed, they got beat. If you looked at the two girls who walked out and won that race, as they came out, they were stony-faced. The 16-year-old who drew the race with the American girl, She cracked a little bit of a smile. The American girl didn't. She was bang. She was dead. She knew what she was there for. And I'm not sure the Campbell girls did realise what they were actually there for at that stage. And my thought were, here goes, hubris from a broadcaster is going to take another gold medal away from an Australian athlete. Because I think they got caught up in the whole hoopla that went along with them.
But I do think, again, and it's something that I get criticised for criticising the media in this country. But again, our media is very ill-informed in a lot of cases. And so when the Olympics come around, they go, oh, well, they're going to win gold because everybody sort of assumes that they're one of the best in the world. But it's not that easy when you get to an Olympic Games or a World Championships. And this, I think, is wrong, is the media pumps this up. And as you touch on there, sometimes these athletes get caught up in that as well. And it's not fair on them, and it's not fair on us, the viewers, or the general public, or even the sport, because the sport suffers, because then it gets criticised for failing. And it hasn't failed. The athletes have still maybe done the best they possibly can, but it's just they've been pumped up so much that then suddenly everyone's disappointed when they don't achieve.
Especially when we're, you know, in the wash over, the wake of this Olympics. It's all about now that the narrative is money. It's finances. That's what the narrative has become. Oh, how much money are we spending on them? How much money are we giving away? We've got to do this and we've got to do that. And, you know, no one can guarantee any medal. So Kitty Chiller's disappointed they didn't get his. Why even come out with a number? When you're asked by the media, how many gold medals do you think you'll win? We'll win the number that we deserve to.
Yeah, but that was the Australian Sports Commission came out with that because of their winning edge program. They actually came out and said, this is the amount of medals we're going to win. These are the sports we're going to win them in.
And those bureaucrats should lose their jobs because patently they haven't done their job.
I 100% agree with that. Absolutely. And I think it's, I said at the time that they did this, it is wrong, it is unfair on those athletes because they will give their best. There's no doubt. I don't think there was a single athlete that represented any country that went out there and didn't give their best.
And I didn't hear, well, actually, Usain Bolt, but I didn't hear any athlete, certainly no Australian athlete, come out and say, oh, yeah, this, I'm going to win this. Lay down Mazaire. Yeah, tick me off, Australian Sports Commission. Put my gold medal down now. In fact, how about sending me the cheque for my gold medal before I've run? None of them said that. No one thinks that they are a dead set certainty to win an Olympic gold medal. If they did, they probably would get beaten.
Just on that gold medal thing, another thing that I feel very strongly about is we are seeing, obviously, a lot of medals being awarded retrospectively. In other words, someone is found guilty of cheating with drugs. And then if we take Jared Talent as an example, he received his gold medal from London in June this year in Melbourne. Now, that's the same year as the Olympics. What I would like to see is all of those athletes who missed out on being on the podium or being on the top of the podium or in the silver medal position, whose medals are upgraded, I would like to see them awarded them retrospectively at the next Olympic Games. And I think what you could do, and to me the IOC and all of the sports could make a really good point, is you actually have a bigger podium and you get all those who were upgraded to gold stand together, united against drugs in sport, same on the silver, same on the bronze, and let's make a real stand and recognise these people. And I also think that the IOC should fly them all at their cost, because they will make money from the games, the IOC. These governing bodies always do. The nation that hosts them necessarily won't, but I think they should have to fly them and the medal presentation. And I'm pleased to say someone from, I wrote a piece on the website, notthefootyshow.com, along these lines. I'm pleased to say someone from one of the top sporting bodies in this country actually contacted me and said, absolutely brilliant point, this should happen.
Oh, I think you do have a good point. Can I just say at the outset, I hate it. I hate the idea of having to present retrospective medals full stop. The idea that we have to do it sucks.
I totally agree, but I just feel for those poor people.
Absolutely. And how do you give them what they've missed out on, and make amends to us as a sporting public as well. We're being
dubbed. We've been ripped off, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I just think that's the closest you can get, but don't give it to a private ceremony in Melbourne in front of his family. I mean, he missed the chance of standing here in the national anthem, seeing the Australian flag up. You can never give that back to him, but you can still make them the focal point and make them feel, you know, a lot better than we probably did by having a private present ceremony.
Just while you're mentioning Jared Talent, I believe he's now Australia's
most successful track and field athlete. Yeah.
Congratulations, Jared.
Yeah. He's made walking trendy.
I've always been a strong walker. I've loved the walk, Ashley. There's nothing like walking.
They astound me how they do it.
Oh, to keep that rhythm up for such a long period of time. And we saw Jane Saville at the Sydney Olympics, and you know how close she got when she picked up that second technical foul. But geez,
yeah, I mean, you have to take your hat off to them.
Yeah,
I just thought quickly on that. I don't know if you saw. There's a big hoo-ha. As you know, I do a lot of work up in India, and there's a big hoo-ha going on about how many of their officials travelled in business class, went to the Olympic Games, and in the marathon for the women's, they had nobody at the drink stations for the Indian girl runners. And so one of them collapsed at the finishing line. She was dehydrated because they had nobody there to supply them with water for the whole of the marathon. One of the other girls, I think it was in the gymnastics or it may have been one of the martial arts, she got through to the quarterfinals and then was going to make the semifinals. Her official doctor had not been a qualified doctor. Suddenly, when she got there, they decided to send a proper medical person to actually be there for her.
Oh, good on them.
But you've got a point on the village. You've got strong feelings on that.
Yeah, if you're selected in the Olympic Games, you stay in the village. You don't stay on some luxury yacht. You abide by the rules of the village and you stay there. The government has spent a lot of money on those villages for you to stay there. And you should stay there. That's what you're selected to do. That's the Olympic experience. And I don't understand how you can separate athletes out into different areas.
If you take, John, and I'm in agreement with you on that one. I think if you want to be at the Olympics, embrace it, stay
Absolutely.
In the village. But you do have a lot of the tennis players like your Federers, your Nadals, who hire an apartment, but they go in the village. And so they sort of want the Olympic experience on their terms. Do you agree with that? Or do you say you have to share
Don't
a room,
go.
The two of you, as well with somebody else?
Yeah, absolutely.
Have a bit of humility.
It's part of, yeah, exactly. You're part of a team. If you really are part of a team, you'll be with the team. I mean, you know, star basketballers, well, let's face it, a lot of them didn't even turn up because
to be fair, they don't fit in the beds if you look at Andrew Bogut's post.
Oh, yeah, but Andrew Bogut's another one of those guys who spent the whole 2 weeks whinging, didn't he? As far as I can tell, or is that just what the media's reporting he said? I don't follow Twitter, so I don't know. I just get told what the media tells me, and all he apparently did for 2 weeks was whinge. And don't whinge about the last foul of the game, Andrew, because you lost by how much? 1 point. Think back to the first quarter when you only scored, 5 points. That might have had a lot more to do with you blokes losing the game than the one foul at the very end of it.
You've gone slightly off the track. But going back to your village thing, there's another thing that I think is very interesting because Kitty Chiller, who was the chef de mission for the Australian Olympic Committee, had came out and said with a few little incidents that happened when people had finished their events that they would be looking in 4 years' time to send athletes home the minute their event is finished. Now, interestingly, I read the same thing that the Americans were saying, a similar sort of story with the misbehaviour of some of their swimmers. Very interesting that we've had two fairly strong Olympic committees coming out with that statement, because I had it on good authority a good 6-9 months ago that Thomas Bach, who is the president of the IOC, that's something he wants, that he wants at the next Olympics, when your event is over, you get on the plane, you go home, because he doesn't want down the track countries spending so much on Olympic villages, so he wants to revamp the way it all works and make it easier. So, I mean, to me, I think that's a little bit unfair. These guys have worked damn hard to get there for 4 years. And then the closing ceremony, well, you're only going to have about 3 men and a dog there.
Yeah, when you think about it, I mean, how many sports finish up in the last day?
Well, swimming's finished the first week, so there'll be no swimmers. And there's probably more swimmers than there are of any other sporting event apart from track and field.
Well, the rugby was done within the first week.
Women's rugby was, yeah.
And the men's?
I think the men's went into the second week.
Only by a day, maybe. But the point being that they wouldn't have been there. I understand why an athlete might want to leave after the first week. Well, what am I doing? I'm sitting on my ass in an Olympic village for 7 days.
Well, we have heard the food hall's good, so you could be getting good free meals.
Yeah. It's up to him. I mean, for some athletes, their sporting program continues. I mean, the Australian hockey players have got their hockey tournament coming up in Melbourne very soon, where India's going to be here, Malaysia, et cetera, et cetera. So for some athletes, the world goes on. And so they might have to leave. They might have to.
It's a difficult one, but I think it's one of those watch this space.
Well, I can understand, too, why the IOC would like governments to be spending less money on the housing side of things, especially when I'm not sure exactly how these buildings are going to be used post-Olympics in Brazil. Are they going to be turned into housing for people from the favelas? Are they going to be turned into some sort of low-cost housing? I don't know what's happened in other... What happened to the accommodation in Beijing? Did they just bulldoze it?
No, I think that's all being lived in. I mean, certainly London, it's actually quite a nice little community.
Hi, I'm Zocco Kalitz, and you're listening to Not The Footy Show.
Should probably get on to our guest for this show, because we caught up with Spencer Pryor, who many will know. He was a pundit on Fox Sports for a while. He's been coaching coaches around the country for the FFA, and he was also the assistant coach to the Matildas when Tom Somani was coach. But there are very limited positions in Australia, and so Spencer's been forced to head overseas into Asia and is now the head coach of the Thailand women's team. Spencer Pryor, welcome to Not The Footy Show.
Thanks, Ash.
Well, Spencer, it's been a while since we've caught up, and you're now find yourself up in Thailand as the national women's coach. First of all, you know, how did that come about?
Well, I was at a real point where I was maybe looking at a career change, because it was limited opportunities in Australia, and I wasn't sure where I was going as a coach. I'd just finished my pro diploma and wasn't quite sure what was around the corner. So I got to a point where I just didn't know where my next move was. And it was literally through an agent that called me that said, would I be interested in coming out here? And next thing I know, I was out here 5 days later. It all happened through Juliana Rabini, Princess's mum. And she put me forward, funny enough, and here I am.
Fantastic. Now, I mean, you raise an issue there, and there are obviously a lot of people getting a lot of coaching qualifications in Australia. And you do worry that there are too many now with pro diplomas and just not enough jobs. So I'm thinking there's going to be a lot of people in your position.
Do you know what? And this is something I've raised with FFA, and I say that because I'm a coach educator over there as well. I'm now qualified and run C licensed courses. There are more and more guys that are going to get through the courses, are going to get whether it's C licensed, B licensed, A licensed, and go on the professional coaching pathway. The standards of the NPL have been raised. I don't think that we can question that, but that's the community called community clubs over there, and they're limited in opportunities and in terms of being able to have the resources behind them to create full-time coaching positions. So what is the pathway for a guy that goes through an A license or a pro diploma? And of course, as we said and you alluded to, there are limited jobs that can really, let's be honest, you can really, really live on. I'm actually in the process of putting a paper together that I think there should be a model in the courses which highlights the pros and cons of a coach that comes and works overseas. I think it's an untapped thing, and I think more and more coaches will start to look at opportunities outside Australia.
I mean, the other thing, Spencer, that's difficult, and it's interesting because you, as you said, have got that education role now. But if you're looking at a club, how are they going to know who's a good coach and who isn't? Because everyone's got the same qualifications. There's limited opportunities. So that means limited experience. So it's very difficult.
Are you talking about in Australia?
Yeah.
I still think there's a little network. I still think that the media have a large say on who gets the roles and who don't get the roles. I think there's a big push towards certain people. I'm not going to hide behind that. I think if you're a Socceroo or a former Socceroo, you definitely tick one box. And maybe that's right, maybe that's wrong, I'm not sure. But, you know, I think there's a reasonable amount of communication that happens between the coaching department and the head coach of FFA or Australia to look at certain people that will go into certain roles. Maybe that's right, maybe that's wrong, I'm not sure. But again, I think going back to the original point, from the pro diploma course that I was on, there was maybe 20 candidates. And since then, there's been another course with maybe another 20 to 25 candidates that are now going to get signed off. That there's 45 pro licensed coaches that have all been developed in the last 3-4 years, and there's not the roles for, or certainly not all of those pro diploma coaches are now coaching in the top division, whether it's the A League or within the national system. And the clubs is okay, but I still think it could be better. I think it could be better.
No, well, obviously you moved up to Thailand to get that opportunity, and you had a pretty good start if we look at the 2016 Asian Football Federation's Women's Championships. You actually took out the title.
Do you know what? We went into it as holders, Ash, and obviously because the fact they were holders, the expectation was, yeah, we'll go and win it again. We had good preparation. We went and had a couple of friendlies in China. But once we got to the tournament, we had a couple of easy games against Singapore and then the Philippines. But we came up against Vietnam, and they were good. And I mean this, they are very good. And they've been in a full-time program for a year. Eric Abrams was over watching, and he said that they were completely unrecognisable from the team that played against Australia the year before, and they looked organised. Everybody knew their role and responsibility, and they beat us 2-0 in the group stage. We played a certain way that matched the philosophy of how I wanted our team to play, and we couldn't cope with it. I'll be honest, we couldn't cope. So for me, the compromising my philosophy to adjust a tactical way to play to try to go and win a tournament was a real challenge, but it was one that we did, and the players adapted well. And yeah, we finished up, beat the Young Matildas in the semi, and then beat Vietnam again in the final, which was pleasing. So it was a good start, good start.
Well, I was going to say the Young Matildas, that's the under-20s. You obviously were the assistant coach to Tom Somani. That must have been almost a very sweet victory, and especially because you came from behind.
Well, I took the Young Matildas as the head coach to Myanmar in 2013, and we came runners-up to Japan under-23s, I think it was, or under-21s. Team in 2013 lost on penalties in the final there, and of course I knew all the girls that were there with the Young Matildas, and I watched them play and spoke to, obviously, to Craig Deans and to Heather through the tournament as well. So it was an interesting game. I would have much rather played them in the final. I spoke to the players before the game. Our players, the Thai players, and said to them, am I allowed to sing the Aussie anthem? And they said, nah, you're with us now. So I said, all right. No. So it was a game we dominated. We went behind, and funny enough, we went behind through an individual error trying to play out from the back. And it was something that you sort of see over in Australia now. Every week you can go and watch a game from under-13s to under-17s in the girls' space and see it happen, where they try and play out, get picked off, and the team go and score. And, you know, that's how Australia scored against us. And, you know, we sort of maintained that we wanted to play our way. and the players worked hard. And to be fair, we won 2-1. It could have been 6 or 7 by the end of the game. We just missed opportunities. And to be fair, they didn't really have many after that. But it was good to beat them. But it was also good to see a lot of the girls that are coming through there in the under-20s.
Now, you mentioned that you were victorious in the final. It was a 1-1 draw against Vietnam and then 6-5 on penalties. But I believe one of those was a little bit controversial and Vietnam still feel that the championship was stolen from them.
Do you know what? I've got no sympathy for them. They were rude and disrespectful in the presentation after. The way they conducted themselves after that penalty was wrong. And if it had been me working with an Australian team and I conducted myself that way, I wouldn't be in a job now. And they refused to come out for the presentation. They were disrespectful to the AFF and AFC, and also to us and the Myanmar who were there to collect their bronze medal. And you know, it was rude. Look, the linesman was stood perfectly looking along the line, and she said the whole ball didn't cross the line. So how the rest of the Vietnam players can tell it crossed the line from where they were on the halfway line or further back is incredible, actually. But the linesman was in a great place. She didn't give it, and therefore it's not a goal. So move on.
Absolutely. Now, talking about that, obviously Thailand, you know, we don't know much about Thai football here in Australia, but what is the standard of the women's team like, and what are your biggest challenges?
Okay, right. I'll go through the challenges first, and that is that we don't have a domestic competition. We had one, but it stopped about 18 months ago. We're about to start it up again in November. There'll be a new league that will be starting in November, and it will be aligned to the Thai Premier League with the TPL clubs and the First Division clubs. We're going to have 10 to 12 teams in the competition. Now, I'm sitting outside of the involvement in the development of that, but obviously, having seen the development of the W League, I'm keen to sort of have some sort of input as to how it looks and what it looks like. So that's our first main challenge, is that we don't have a domestic league at the moment. Once we fix that, then the players will get regular competition. So right now, the only competition that our national team players get is they come into camp with us, and every week we'll play 2 games against under 16 boys. What that also means is that by not us having a domestic comp, Ash, is that we've got maybe a pool of 24, 25 players, and that's it. That is it. So I'm pulling on these players without having real depth in terms of numbers. And we've seen through with the Matildas, Stag could have picked. He could have picked a different 18 to go to the Olympics, and they still, the perception would have been that they were still as good as the 18 that went. And he was able to leave players back that could have walked into any other national team, or certainly into our national team anyway. So we don't have good depth, but we'll get that once we develop a competition. And we'll start to then develop more players that will challenge the ones that are already in the squad. I think that that's a real key factor, is to get greater depth. The quality of the individuals that we've got, technically very good, physically not great. I've come in and trying to change the culture of the athlete. So we're looking at the nutrition of the players as well. It's a real challenge, Ash, in terms of the diet of a player. You know, they have rice like 3 times a day. Right? I mean, there's only so much rice you can have, and before you start putting on, whether you like putting on the kgs, and it's a real challenge, but you know, we're trying. We're trying to make steps, but without doing it too drastically.
Now, it certainly sounds though as if the women's game in Asia is really gaining a bit of momentum now, and we're going to see, not necessarily in the next couple of years, but probably 5 or 6 years down the track, it won't just be Japan, China's, and the Matildas that are dominating.
Well, again, I say this, and Vietnam were really good, right? So right now you've got Australia, Japan, China, North Korea, South Korea, right? So you've got five good teams, real good top teams. And the reality is you're competing for 3 to 4 spots at a World Cup. So it's an unbelievably hard federation to get out of. And Vietnam have really set their game up. Japan have had a transition, and I think they've gone through that already. They played the US and had good results over there recently after that transition. So they missed out on the Olympics, but I think they've gone through their transition now. North Korea, God knows what they're doing. They're just doing whatever they want to do. No one will really know until we see them in sort of 2 years' time. China have got obviously great numbers, and they're quite a young squad. We played them prior to the Olympics, and they're strong. Australia obviously have got the numbers they've got. It's a really, really hard confederation to get out. And if you miss out on a World Cup, then it can risk the funding. Fortunately for us, the federation still want to be, they still see the being the best in South Asia as a priority. So the AFF is very important. So it's the SEA Games. So there's always stuff outside of the AFC where they want to be the best, but they also do want to try and break into the top 4 or 5 within AFC. And you need good resources behind it, Ash. You know, money does count. It really does. Seeing what Australia did to get into the World Cup and do what they did at the World Cup and then the Olympics, it come at a cost. You know, it did. It come at a cost. It doesn't really. It's like the white elephant in the room, but there is one budget. There's one budget, and there ain't no more money coming after that budget. So whatever went into the Matildas has been to the detriment of the underpinning programs, right? It's true. How many camps has the under-17s girls had and the young Matildas? Next to nothing. And that's the cost of having a successful senior team. But the thing is, does the success of the senior team then lead to more money coming into the game? And this is the point where we need to look at and say, okay, right, what is our priority? Is it putting the resources into the younger team to really give us more players coming through, or is it to just stick them all into the senior team? I think if you try and get a balance, Ash, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. You've got to go one way or the other. And I think we're still trying to find our way here with which way we want to go with that.
Well, it sounds very challenging, but I suppose the last question, Spencer, is, are you enjoying it up there? It sounds like you are.
Do you know, it's a great challenge, and it's challenging me professionally. And like I said, I had to compromise my own philosophies or my own philosophy on how I wanted to play mid-tournament to be successful. But that's one thing I love about it is that we're in a performance phase and it's about winning. And I want to get success in that. The football culture out here is immense. It really is, honestly. The girls, you know, when we played in China, we had 500,000 hits on our Facebook page, people watching the game. So it's... Wow. It's huge following for the girls game here. The Thai Premier League for the men's is a great comp. Big crowds, And, you know, it's good. It's a great developing league as well. So the football culture here is good. The challenge is being away from family who are still living in Sydney. But, you know, we're trying. We're having a go at it. I came over with the family's blessing. You know what? If it don't work out, just come back. But I'll be a better coach for the experience that I've had here.
Well, Spencer, great to catch up with you, and hopefully we talk again soon.
Look forward to it.
This is Gary Lineker, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Well, that was Spencer Pryor, the women's coach of Thailand, and I reckon he would have really enjoyed in that tournament beating Australia in the semi-finals, and sounds like he's got a very testing time in Thailand in that with diet and getting the players fit. And I mean, when you think, John, they've had no league up there and they haven't played for 9 months, and then he took them to China where they got beaten, and he goes, you know, now they've got a league, so now they can get players, they can increase the talent pool, and the girls can be playing. I mean, and that's one of the hard things in these countries, and I think sometimes people don't appreciate how far the women's game has come here. To the credit of the FFA, they have set up the W League. You know, there are more players playing. It is a good standard, and that's why the Matildas are flourishing.
I think facilities are a big issue in countries like that. I remember seeing the home ground for the Sulawesi team in the Indonesian League, and there were animals grazing on it as we went past. I kid you not. And I think that for a lot of these countries like Malaysia, that they don't have the facilities. You know, the grounds, just the ground facilities are generally of a poor standard, and it makes it difficult for them to learn any skill, really, doesn't it?
One thing that does worry me, though, and I think Spencer alluded to it in that interview, is that, you know, the FFA, though, have directed a lot of money to the Matildas, which is probably going to be to the detriment of the sort of competitions or the teams underpinning the Matildas. And that's a worry, because the minute you start robbing your development to support the top end, you're then on very shaky foundations.
Oh, absolutely. More milk you get, more cream you get. It's always been my theory. And if you start pumping too much money into the top end, then the bottom end's going to fall away. It has to. Simple. It's, you know, logic, isn't it?
Anyway, that leads us in nicely, because obviously since we last podcast, there's been the announcement by Football West that they are looking in 3 to 5 years to have a second licence in the A-League here in WA, which, you know, I think has a lot of merit, in that suddenly you would have a genuine derby in Western Australia, depending on where the team is based, depending on what it's called, etc., etc. But you would have two teams, so they would be vying off against each other, which when you look at the A-League, where teams play each other three times, you'd have 6 games in WA where you should have really good crowds. Now, the one thing I just want to say is Football West have been very quick to point out that they're doing an assessment on this to look at what the public want and whatever. Now, that's great. I have no problem with that. What worries me, though, is who's going to have access to that information? Like, if, say, a private bidder wants to come in and try and get the A-League licence in WA, if one is up for grabs, will they be privy to that information? Hopefully they will be. And the other concern that I do have, and I'm not saying that this is the case, but it's something you think, I think, needs to be put on the table now, is if you look at the current board, there's only 2 board members who will still have positions on the board in 4 years' time. Saying that if they go to their full term. So therefore, what's to stop any of those other board members having Football West fund such an investigation, then go away and bid privately for the A-League licence? So they haven't done the due diligence themselves. They've got the body that they're involved with. Now, I'm not saying that is the case. I'm just saying, but there is the possibility of that happening.
Well, we both know that the prospect of a second term in Perth has been floated before. I mean, been people that have looked into it, and it hasn't come off for whatever reasons, have decided against it, or there's been factors that mitigate against it, and I'm not so sure that those factors don't still exist. How many people do they get to a Perth Glory game?
Yeah, well, paying it's it's a difficult one because there's a lot of free tickets given away. They're averaging about 7,000 or 8,000 last year. I would say of those, you're getting probably 4,000 to 5,000 paying regularly to go.
See, I'm not sure if that's sustainable, if that makes two teams sustainable.
The only thing, John, that you have to look into that, there are a lot of people who are disenchanted with Glory in the way they've treated the local clubs. There's a lot of people disenchanted with Tony Sage as an owner, and I know a lot of people who will not go as long as he owns the license in WA. And then there are a lot of people who were very felt dudded when they got done for the illegal payments of players. So there's sort of three or four factions as to why a lot of people will not go and support the Glory, who may well go to a new club. But the other thing that worries me is, as you say, is if you bring in another franchise, will it kill the Glory completely? And I think that is a very serious possibility.
I think you've got to be careful about when... I can see a day when another franchise does exist in Perth. I think you've got to be careful about when you introduce it. I mean,
I'm not sure I do, to be honest. I don't think the A-League is in a position, and I don't think in the foreseeable future, it is, even in 5 years' time, it is going to be sustainable to have two teams in WA.
I think it's a long time off it yet. Yeah. I can see the day when it does happen, but I can't see it happening in the immediate future.
I mean, if you look, the A-League now, I think it's its 12th year or 13th year about to start, and you've only got one club in the black. That is not a good state of affairs, and I don't think the FFA are going to want to actually come in. The other issue that I see as well as a stumbling block, possibly, if it is Football West that is going to own this licence, is that by 2019, it was meant to be by 2017, the Asia Football Confederation has said they do not want any competitions owned by that country's governing body. So by 2019, which is 3 years' time, the A-League should be separate from the FFA, which is what all the clubs want. But therefore, as Football West is sort of like a state arm of the FFA, then there's no way they could own that license if those are the rules or the way I perceive it. I don't see how that could possibly happen.
Well, you shouldn't have a governing body owning teams in a competition they run anyway, or a link to. Just makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, but of course, the success of Western Sydney, you know, the FFA will go, well, look what we did. The one thing that nobody's actually looked at is the amount of cost-cutting, get it right eventually, that the owners of Western Sydney had to do once they bought the licence, in that they culled the staff in the back room, because at the time Western Sydney had more staff in the administration than any other club in the A-League, and also they had to get rid of some of the higher paid players that the FFA had there. So again, if you look at the costs that were cut at Western Sydney by the owners when they took it over, and I've asked to his face, Mr. Gallup, how much did Western Sydney cost the FFA? And they've refused to tell me. I asked him twice in the...
Well, maybe that's where the $40 million went.
I don't think so. I think we know where that went.
And it's a tough question for football in this country, too. I mean, the A-League has got some traction, it's got to be said, but I don't think it's got the traction that it really needs to propel itself further ahead. Tim Cahill, he might change that. I don't think one man can do that.
I don't think he's going to be playing as much as everybody thinks.
Maybe not.
Here to market the A-League.
That's
and
true.
He's going to be doing marketing duties for the FFA. But again, I find it very, very sad, and I've said this for a long time, in that they did it with Harry Kewell. Tim Cahill's at the end of his career. He's 36 years old. You shouldn't... It's pretty sad to me if he is your number one marketing tool at the age of 36, at the end of his career. At his peak marketing interest should have been probably 3, 4, 5 years ago, as was Harry Kewell again, but they kept them hanging on. They should be in the next generation that they should be promoting now as the marketing faces of the A-League or the faces of the Socceroos, not a 36-year-old.
The problem is we haven't got the players that can do that. I mean... Tim Cahill, maybe he's one out of a box. He was scoring goals in the Premier League. When we got a bloke who's scoring goals in the Premier League again, you can use him to market it. But you don't just pick a player and go, oh, this bloke's good. He's pretty good. Everybody get behind him. He's a great fella. It doesn't work that way.
No, I mean, look, you've got Mile Jedinek, the captain of the Socceroos, but you know, you don't see him being pushed out apart from for Socceroos.
Because he plays at fullback.
He plays midfield.
Oh, midfield. He's a fullback.
But he is...
Every bloke on a soccer field, they call a midfielder these days.
But Mino Jedinak is the highest profile player Australia's got and in playing in the best competition.
And I'll tell you right now, you'd be hard pressed to find more than 2 in 10 that would know that.
Yeah, which is my point, you know.
And but hey, it's about scoring goals. They're who your marquee men are. They're your glamour boys. They're the people that bring others through the gate.
But if you're
only hardcore football fans.
But if you're saying that, John, I mean, Harry Kewell didn't score that many goals because he wasn't a striker.
He was a wide player. There was a perception that he was a goal scoring hero.
No, he didn't. But if you look at his career,
but we're talking outside of soccer nuff-nuffs like you who know all of their stuff, right? We're talking about blokes like me. And that's where marketing works. It doesn't work for blokes like you. The greater marketing is got to work on people like me. And my perception is that, Harry Kewell scored a few goals because that's all we used to see him do. You never see Milo Jednik score a goal. I know he does, okay, but...
I hear your argument.
You know what I mean? And that's where the glamour money is scoring goals. And that's who you need. You need your Tim Cahill jumping in the air and throwing his hands up, bashing up corner posts and, you know, kicking shirts, kissing shirts and stuff.
But just on that then, again, just to throw that one out there, I mean, I find it sad that, you know, Tim Cahill is the first Australian player to score in 3 consecutive World Cups. There's very few women have actually achieved that. Lisa Devana, a West Australian, is the actual one of the few women to have done that. Yet, has she shared anywhere near the limelight for doing that, for that achievement, which is a phenomenal achievement by anybody, male or female? You know, so it's marketing or it's promotion by the FFA. And again, to me, it goes back to that. I don't think the FFA is very good at its promotion of football. The first year of the A-League was outstanding, but then I think the money ran out and we've not seen a great deal of promotion ever since then. And I just find it sad. And I just think hanging your hat on a 36-year-old to me is really almost a last roll of the dice.
What I found interesting was the decision not to allow Melbourne Victory to sign their guest player.
Guest marquee player for the season. It's this new category they've got.
Yeah, and you know, Tim Cahill comes under that, but this other bloke doesn't. And when you look at where he is in his career, I'm sorry, the guy's name slips me.
I've forgotten. It begins with B, I think. I've forgotten it now myself.
When you look, he's still a player that's pretty much in his prime. Why wouldn't you take him? Why wouldn't you let them sign him? That, to me, is more staggering decision.
Well, we'll leave that question, I think, hanging in the air because we'll wrap up this show. If you've got your thoughts, please put your comments on the website or even on our Facebook page when the podcast comes up. But we hope you've enjoyed it and we hope we'll catch up with you on the next podcast.
Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over.
See ya. We'll be back next week.